The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
Coming to you from the remote Carter Subaru studio. Welcome back to The Big Show. Could be an eventful hour for especially our school kids and parents in the state, as coming up at about 2:30, we are expecting to hear from Governor Jay Inslee and Superintendent of Public Instruction, Chris Rakedahl, and they are going to announce if there's any chance that they are going to get schools reopened before the end of this school year. And so we'll find out from them at 2:30 this afternoon. We're going to bring that to you live here on 97.3 Cairo FM. We're also going to bring you the White House Coronavirus Task Force briefing that was scheduled to start at 2 o'clock this afternoon. They have usually been running 10 to 15 to 20 minutes late, so who knows when it's going to get going at the White House. And there is something that I would ask of you as a citizen. You should deluge Jay Inslee's office, and this isn't about politics in the slightest, but I feel like we at Cairo, like what we've done, and you know, our management's made, you know, a significant commitment to just going live and commercial free, whether it's the governor or the president. And as I've said many times, we don't care about the political spectrum when it comes to getting you information. And last week, the White House Coronavirus Task Force briefings were very informative. And I think the federal government, I mean, we're hearing some jam ups with businesses trying to get these loans from the banks, the small business loans that we're told could evolve into grants if they keep the payroll, if they were to hire more people. It's a great deal. They're acting with speed to get money to the unemployed. And they've acted in a business way, not a government way, to try to help out in this unprecedented economic crisis. And I think that that's really important information. I also recognize that if you're the parent of a school kid, if you are a high school kid, if you are especially a high school senior, there is nothing more important to you right now than, am I going to be back in school? Am I going to see my friends before the end of the school year? And I told you about an email my wife got from a friend of hers. And the wife was talking about how her daughter is a senior, has had the closest, dearest group of friends. And, you know, you get so close. When our kids were in high school, it was our kids' friends' parents who became our best friends, and we would travel to basketball tournaments together, and that becomes your universe through your kids. And this mom said she just had this realization that if there's not going to be Kane Lotta, graduation, senior spree, which a lot of kids have already paid for, and that money's got to somehow, I wonder if that's insured. I don't even know about that. Graduation, senior prom. And this mom said she had this realization that if this stay-at-home social distancing, if it extends into the summer and all of these dearest friends that have been hanging out at her house since they were little tiny kids, they all go off to college. She said she realized she might never see these kids again. And it was so sad to think about that, because we've all gone cold turkey with some, whether it's with our job or with the business that we've put blood, sweat, and tears into, friends, everybody's making the shared sacrifice. So getting back to my original point, ask the governor to stop scheduling his press conference at the same time as the White House. We want to bring you both. And Governor Inslee is choosing to just be very, very petty and to try to upstate. And then everybody says, well, if you feel that way, Dory, why don't you just carry the president's? Because we're Cairo Radio. We are, always have been, the voice of Western Washington. And when it comes to prioritization, we prioritize local. And like I've said, I think whatever announcement comes out of this Inslee-Chris Rakedahl thing today, it is going to be very important to families. And but I would love to be able to bring you both. And so I think you should get a hold of the governor and ask him, stop scheduling his press conferences opposite the president's. It is just an act of political petulance by the governor. And I think that the people of Washington State deserve to hear from their governor. They also deserve to hear from their president. But Inslee's making you choose because he's scheduling it at the same time. And I think that is a punk move. Okay, we're waiting for the coronavirus task force briefing to begin. Again, the governor is scheduled to go at 2:30. We'll bring that to you live. In the meantime, let's get to the big lead.
The big lead, top story.
Another bit of inconsistency with what businesses are shut down, which ones cannot or can keep operating. Gun stores have been told that they have to shut down. And this is where this kind of thing gets really scary to me. Can somebody explain to me why marijuana shops are still open, but something that deals in a product that is specifically protected by our Second Amendment, why those stores are closed? And why I'm worried about this is because inevitably history tells us that when there is economic turmoil, that crime soon follows. And our colleague Jason Rance on KTTH, he has a story that's up on My Northwest this afternoon, that in downtown Seattle, burglary cases are up 87% as of Friday, April 3rd. And that's in the West Precinct that covers downtown Seattle. And that's apparently, as more and more businesses have closed down, the criminal drug vagrants are taking advantage, but an 87% increase. But here's what I know. This is going to spread to the neighborhoods. It's going to spread to the homes. And there are an awful lot of families who understand that the police don't have the resources to get any place in a timely fashion these days. And so there are many people who choose to be their own first line of defense by having a gun for personal protection. And if we're seeing crime skyrocket in Seattle, you know it is going to soon come, and that's in downtown Seattle specifically. But Capitol Hill is up 17%, citywide, a 21% increase in burglaries in the last month. And we have only scratched the surface of the economic turmoil that is to come. And I have always been, not always, but you know, for the last several years, I have been a believer in being ready to protect my family and my home and myself. And so at a time when government is, and again, I'm not critical of staying home, I think mitigation has been necessary. But at a time when government is mandating people being out of work, our economy just on hold, and the turmoil that follows it, and government says, oh, and by the way, you can't go get a gun to protect your home if the crime comes to your neighborhood. That's insanity. And the marijuana shops are open, but Second Amendment protected right to obtain a firearm, those shops are closed by government edict. And that's where I say this is the kind of thing that, you know, if nobody else will, I will continue to watchdog this stuff because we cannot give up rights for, you know, this perceived health emergency. We can all join in. We can all do what we can to try to mitigate the exposure to COVID-19. but we cannot let government run roughshod over us. So be aware, crime stats probably will spread to the suburbs, to many more neighborhoods, and Jay Inslee should open the gun shops back up as an essential business. Up next in the big lead.
What do we got here, Dory?
I don't know. I got nothing. And people have to understand, I'm now on my third mode of transmission since the show started. I have a broadcast line at my house. That blew up about a half hour ago. I finished last half hour by phone, and now I'm on an app on my phone. How's the quality of this, Sean? Is it okay?
Yeah, it sounds pretty good, Dory. It's just nice to have you back on the air.
Is it really good?
Well, of course, if you were in studio, it would be the best, but compared to what we have.
Yeah, that ain't never happening again. I'm never coming back.
There. I know. Now, this sounds good.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Well, can Nicole fire audio? Because I've lost that capability.
Yeah.
Yes.
Hey. Oh, I can talk to you, Nicole.
Well,
look at this.
We'll see until I start breaking up again.
Was I breaking up?
No. I think I've been having issues.
Oh, yeah.
I've heard breaking up is hard to do, but apparently
today it's
very easy.
I want to play this for people. And then, Sean, we'll see if we can get a break in before we go to the White House coronavirus task force briefing. So,
sure. So
I'll toss it to that in just a minute here. But first, you probably have not heard that a woman has come forward with a very detailed accusation of sexual assault against Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. Now, this is a story that all of the networks and major newspapers have absolutely buried, but she says it happened about 35 years ago. And I thought this was interesting. Alyssa Milano, who flew to Washington, D.C. for the Kavanaugh hearings, and she said, women must always be believed, and I'm here to support Kavanaugh's accuser. Well, I'll give him credit. Alyssa Milano went on Andy Cohen's radio show, and Andy Cohen did what most so-called journalists at the national level would not. But he asked Alyssa Milano, you said women should always be believed, and yet you have endorsed Joe Biden, who now has a credible sexual assault allegation against him. And here's what Alyssa Milano had to say about that.
Because I believe that even though we should believe women, and that is an important thing, and what that statement really means is, like, you know, for so long the go-to has been not to believe them. So really we have to sort of societally change that mindset to believing women, but that does not mean at the expense of not giving men their due process.
Now, I have to translate leftist speak. What she's saying is, if the man accused of sexual assault is conservative, then the woman is telling the truth and she is to always be believed. If the man accused of sexual assault is a liberal, then we doubt the woman and we will always defend the politician. So that's what she was trying to say. She didn't say it as plain spoken as I, but that's the way the left operates. That it only thing that matters is the politics of the person accused. And so Joe Biden has gotten a complete free pass on this from everybody in the national media. I couldn't let it go without at least sharing with you just the pure hypocrisy of people like Alyssa Milano. Okay, we're expecting the White House briefing in just minutes, and then Inslee's pretty much been starting on time. So from Olympia, Inslee and Chris Rakedahl, are they going to get the schools reopened before the end of this school year? Let me take a quick time out, and then we'll walk you right up to those dueling press conferences as our coverage continues here on the Dory Monson Show. And I tell you what, if I was governor, my press conferences would start on time. I'd run this place like a Swiss watch. So Governor Inslee and Chris Rakedahl, they are, you know what? I wonder if they're delaying theirs. I'm serious. I just thought about this. We just got word about 5 minutes ago that the White House COVID or coronavirus task force briefing is now scheduled to start at 2:45. I wonder if Inslee, who's been on time with all of his pressers, I wonder if he's delaying it because they got word that the White House is going at 2:45 and he wants to bump the president. He couldn't beat him when he was trying to run for the presidency. So maybe in another act of childish petulance, that's why Governor Inslee and Chris Rakedal's press conference is delayed. So they're running about 6 minutes late. I don't think his press conferences have been 6 minutes late as long back as I can remember, since he started doing these about a month ago. So we'll bring that to you live here on the Dory Monson Show in Cairo Radio. Hey, I got another I told you so. One casualty of this coronavirus outbreak. Remember when cities became all the rage to pass plastic bag bans? And I went to the grocery store over the weekend. And as I was checking out, the lady said, paper or plastic? And I said, I thought our city banned plastic bags. And she said, no, they've overturned it during the crisis. Oh, I'm seeing Jay Inslee. Do we have Jay Inslee ready to go there, Sean? I'll get back to my plastic bag thing.
You know, I am seeing he's about to come up on my screen here momentarily.
Oh, my screen's ahead of yours. Okay, let's take you to Olympia Live, the governor's update on the outbreak and what's going to happen with our school kids. You're hearing it live on the Dory Monson Show, 97.3 Cairo FM.
Confirmed COVID-19 cases in Washington. We have lost 338 Washingtonians to this virus. A little over 3 weeks ago, my office, along with Superintendent Rakedal, who has joined me today, closed our on-site K-12 education statewide in our early efforts to flatten the curve of this virus. Today, I'm extending the on-site instruction closure order. All public and private K-12 schools in our state will be ending, they'll be stopped from providing traditional in-person instruction through the end of this school year in June. But all schools will continue distance learning until the end of the school year. This decision is made on the clear epidemiological evidence that in order to give us a higher degree of confidence that we will suppress this pandemic, we simply cannot take the chance of reopening on-site instruction in this calendar school year. We do believe we're making some progress in our state, and Washingtonians should be proud of this. It's reasonable to expect this time will give us what we need to feel secure we have come through the worst of this pandemic. Our efforts are as important as the curve of the pandemic goes down as they were when the curve was going up. This school closure is part and parcel of those efforts, not only to flatten the curve as it goes up, but to reduce the number of deaths that occur as it goes down. We cannot risk losing the gains we have made after the peak of this pandemic presumably will have passed. This closure order will also allow educators to fully focus their energies and their amazing creative talents on the best way to provide education to their students in this challenging circumstance. I've spoken to local and superintendents across the state as recently this morning about how this will impact their communities. This decision, like every decision we've made during this crisis, is very difficult. I've also heard directly from educators, parents, and students about how the current closure is affecting them and their families' lives. If you're a senior in good standing, we expect that you will receive your diploma this year. And I've seen school communities come together in really amazing ways. For example, since the statewide closure began in mid-March, our schools have served more than 2 million meals to young people who need them. We have bus drivers delivering meals to student homes, educators who are volunteering to hand out meals at school sites, and sending parents home with multiple days' worth of meals at one time in order to limit the exposure of others. The creativity of people is really amazing in our state. And our school districts are rising to the challenge of caring for the children of our healthcare workers and our first responders, our pharmacy workers and our grocery store workers. They've served more than 2,000 children in the very first week of operation and are making several more thousand openings available. We know nationally at least 13 states and territories have closed their schools for the remainder of the school year, with many converting their traditional in-person instructional model to a distance or online model. Now, I do want to be clear about this. Transforming a traditional school and fully delivering instruction at a distance or through an online portal is no small feat. Our traditional learning model has been nearly 150 years in the making. We know that distance learning could never replace the learning and other benefits that students get from attending school in person. But this unprecedented health emergency demands that we take this step, both for the sake of our children and for our community. I'm asking districts and educators to do your best during this tough time to perfect as much as possible a distance learning model. And we've also got to ensure that our seniors have the opportunity to get the credits they need to graduate. Now, students, if I can speak to you just for a second, your grades will not suffer because of this, but we need you to do your part, too. Your educators will continue teaching, though it will look different, certainly, than what you're used to. And I really hope you can use this moment to embrace learning when you're older. I think you'll be glad you did. And I got to tell you, I've seen amazing learning going on of students looking at new arts and new sciences and new ways of doing things. It's really been inspiring to me to see students really using this time in really, really creative ways to maybe try things they've never tried before. I appreciate that, including my young grandson who just started his life list of bird watching. So far, he's got 3 finches, 1 robin, and 3 crows. So things are moving forward. I expect our local education associations to be flexible in the collective bargaining agreements and to work closely with their superintendents and school board members to determine the best path forward. And I think it's fair that we all expect school districts to provide some flexibility, too, in your expectations of staff and students. Together, we will ensure that learning continues in the state of Washington. Now, we are working with our internet providers and software leaders in our state and other private sector partners to connect our students and educators for what they need in teaching. We have partners in higher education and schools and libraries that are also helping us set up interconnected hotspots in urban and rural areas across the state. And we're going to ask all those partners to step up to the plate to the extent humanly possible to get as many kids well-connected as humanly possible in the state of Washington. We know closing schools also presents challenges in the need for equity in education, and not only because of internet connectivity issues. Students learning English as a second language, students with disabilities, and other vulnerable students, we know this is a challenging time for their learning. So we are addressing this by allowing limited school activity for those students in school buildings that really follow social distancing guidelines, similar to the Department of Health guidelines for child care. And I'm asking school and community leaders to help us in ensuring access for these students. For any children watching today, it would be very normal to feel a little anxious about all this, not getting to see your friends as much as you want. And we understand that. And I'd like to invoke the words from a fellow who may be even before some of the students' time, named Mr. Fred Rogers. And what he said was, Everyone has lots of ways of feeling, and all those ways of feeling are fine. It's what we do with our feelings that matter. And I want you to know that we're going to get through this. You're just as important in this effort as your parents and your grandparents, and we look forward to your bright futures. Now, if there's any opportunity to bring students back for a few days later in the year, including graduation ceremonies for seniors, we're going to explore that option as the evidence continues to come in. That opportunity will be guided by our collective behavior and the success we achieve with the choices that we're making today. So stay home, stay healthy, wash your hands, and now I'll defer to the superintendent, who has been such a tremendous partner in going through these challenges.
Thank you, Governor Inslee. I'm Superintendent of Public Instruction Chris Rakedahl, and I thank the governor for his leadership. Washington State acted very early on a number of fronts that has helped us begin to address the essential need to flatten the curve, as we talk about. These are difficult times, and this is a tough day for us in Washington State. I take heart that the concern we have heard from parents and students and teachers and administrators, school board members, and community members about closing schools is a function of how deeply ingrained it is into our Washington way of life. We know the value of school and the power of learning, and people are nervous about that. We are one of 50 states who are closed now. We are one of now 14 states who have closed for the rest of the school year. Our neighbors, Oregon and Idaho, are contemplating it as we speak, and we expect dozens of additional states to close for the rest of the year. That's more than 50 million students around the nation who are not learning in a traditional model. And we are fortunate to have a framework here of high expectations, which we rolled out last week. And you saw in each of our communities a significant uptick in the amount of family engagement and student engagement around learning. Prior to that, as you heard from the governor, more than 2 million meals were served in the first 10 days or so of our shutdown. 4,000 plus childcare slots were made available. About 2,000 plus students are currently being served with additional capacity. And learning around the state has moved forward. From Highline to Aberdeen, from Bellingham to Vancouver, Spokane, Moses Lake, White River School District, the list goes on. Incredible learning opportunities for families, a significant engagement by our staff, and I want to thank our school districts around the state who are continuing to improve and get better in our distance model. The contemplation here for me is a tough one, as it has been for the governor, because we also want to always keep in mind that while learning is a paramount duty to the state, the health of our people is first and foremost. The return to school is a very difficult contemplation. If you can imagine coming out of this the way we went into it, you can understand the challenge of people wanting to rush too soon back to school. The second there would be a case of a student or a faculty member, the entire school would be shut down. We would clean it for 2 to 5 days. We would have to trace and track as many of those contacts as possible. A rush back to school puts significant risk in learning continuity that at this time would not be better than the model we are developing and advancing at a distance. We do not want that curve to suddenly spike up because we acted too quickly to come back. It does call into question this fall. And we have been candid and given signals to folks for a long time that because of the leadership of our governor, he is doing an incredible job flattening that curve and making the people of the state of Washington safer. But when you lower the curve and flatten the curve, you do it for longer. And so we are already trying to contemplate what life means like coming back to school in the fall as both a traditional face-to-face model, should we get the right science in our favor. But also we know we have to be significantly better at this distance model in case we find ourselves in that reality. I am personally challenging the private sector partners that I've been working with and the governor's been working with and others, particularly in telecom. We have to get connectivity to all of our students. This is a once in a 100-year pandemic that compels us to do this today more than ever, but there will be something else. Natural disaster, significant weather events, future disease. This is a big moment for us to transform. And I am reminded of our sixth superintendent of the state of Washington. Her name is Josephine Preston. She was the first a female superintendent elected in the state and the first statewide elected official who was a woman. She was a suffragist who helped bring the important right of voting to women in the state. In the middle of her own pandemic crisis and the beginning of her second term, she not only mustered the strength and the wisdom to lead the school system through that, but she sowed the seeds of something that today we would think is incredibly normal, but it was quite innovative at the time. This particular superintendent in the midst of a pandemic said, when we come out of this, we ought to be different. It was the seeds of kindergarten in our state. It was the seeds of an amazing concept called middle school and high school, which did not exist 100 years ago in the way we know it today. She was a leader. And from the seeds of crisis come the strong, strong roots and blossom of innovation. And that's the moment we find ourselves in today. The disease is compelling us to have an education challenge, but our task is to rise to it, to engage our families and our students, to continue learning, get our students moved to their next grade, get our seniors graduated to incredible opportunities, and to forever transform our system for a better opportunity should it come and emerge in the future. In the next decade, this state ought to lead the country in a belief that not only should everyone have access to health care, which we have clearly been a leader on nationally, but if there is anyone today who does not see telecom and connectivity as an essential utility, much like water and clean air, then I would challenge them to think about our history. Right now, we must sow the seeds of a complete innovation and connectivity for families. It is the way we will learn. It is the way of the future. We will never replace face-to-face learning. It is the best model for all its comprehensive supports. But right now, this is our moment to connect every family and see it as much as a right to be connected as clean water. Thank you, and I know the governor and I stand for questions.
Listening to the governor and the superintendent of public instruction, all public schools will remain closed for the rest of the school year. That is the most important announcement impacting your lives. They're going to take some questions. We're going to carry that live. The president is also speaking right now. We are monitoring that. We got you covered. But now back to Olympia we go here on the Dory Monson Show in 97.3 Cairo FM.
Yes, we use data from all around the world, starting at the University of Washington, the Institute, which is really recognized as the modeling institute in the world today. We're so fortunate to have them available. We call them when we want advice. I talked to Dr. Murray a few days ago about the specifics of his model. We look at other models from other modeling agencies. We look at our daily data, including the rate of hospitalizations that happen that day that have COVID-like symptoms. We watch that with intense interest. What percentage of the admissions are people who had COVID-like illnesses? We look at our rate of positive test results that come in. We obviously look at our fatalities. We look at our traffic data from a variety of sources, first from the Department of Transportation on our roadways, and we have good data on that from our ferries, from our light rail and bus systems. We also look at telephonic and network connections that are modeled. I know this will trouble someone, but some people, but people's location is actually tracked, and you can determine what distances they've traveled. That's anonymous, so we have no idea who these folks are. But we look at that to determine how many social interactions or physical interactions, how much that's been reduced because of our Stay Home, Stay Healthy initiative. Then we look at all of those things together to look at trends. Obviously, trends are more important than an individual data point. Those trends have been trending somewhat favorable for us. I think you've heard Dr. Brooks from the administration noting this on a national basis, that our trend lines are favorable, particularly relative to other states. But I do want to reiterate this. Our fatalities are still going up. We have not reached the peak of this pandemic. We don't know where that peak is. And between us and that peak are, unfortunately, the loss of lives of Washingtonians. And that's why we ought to remain very committed to all we're doing. Second point I want to make, and this is really important in the context of this school closure issue. As the curve goes up, all of us are intensely focused on what is happening in fatalities and infection rates and the like. But you can have the same number of fatalities on the backside of that curve as it's going down. So we have to be intensely committed to this, even as the rate of fatalities per day will go down, and we hope that sooner rather than later. So there will be a very human kind of inclination to pop the champagne corks and go back to visiting our friends and going back to school once we're past that curve, but we just can't do that. It's too deadly. And that's one of the reasons we made this decision.
Again, Superintendent Rakedahl here. We're seeing some pretty remarkable innovation around the state. We've got school districts who, of course, were pretty advanced in their online learning models. Their professional development for their staff was commensurate with that. They were prepared in some ways for a moment like this, though nobody could have expected something like this. These are districts who were at the forefront of thinking in terms of distance learning, and that's gone very, very well. What I would love to see us do in greater scale is obviously get connectivity for our families. Our students need devices, and everyone needs connectivity and access. There's a lot of rich, dense video going on right now, so even a slow connection can be a significant limitation. The other thing is we know there are districts with pretty remarkable models right now serving students with disabilities at a distance. They are developing those individual education programs and updating them, again, through conference. Through student learning management systems that are digital and online and engaging families. So we're going to take pockets of excellence and scale that at this point. The partnership of the private sector and getting everyone connected will be essential here. Developing our staff so that they're better prepared and improving will be part of it. But definitely our supports for students with disabilities and just scaling what we're already doing is the big task of the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, a question for the governor. Two-part question. So, governor, residents in other states like Oregon, California, Vermont, Minnesota, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Virginia are getting timely and public hospitalization data from their governments, and Washington aren't seeing that yet. The only thing we've got right now is a DOH graphic that's a week out of date and doesn't give hard numbers. So as residents across the state have questions about the outbreak and the data used to justify emergency orders, how do you justify the lack of transparency?
Well,
my second question is related. It's what data informed your decision to send 400 ventilators back to the national stockpile? Was it hospital data? Was it the UW modeling numbers? And do you think that there are need for other gear like gloves, gowns, and masks is also going to go down?
So I'm not sure I understand, Joe. We'll have to check to see what you're referring to, but the EPI report is on the website. I looked at it the other night. I believe it has both the graphical representation of the hospitalizations as a percentage, and from the percentage you can look at the number and it will show the total hospitalizations. And so I think that information is on the website. There is a delay of a couple days getting the information onto the system. So I will ask DOH to look at that if there's something we can do to accelerate getting that information to you. We'd like to be as transparent as possible, obviously. So we'll check on that to see if there's something you're not getting that I think you should. I think it's on the website, but we'll check on that. I'll get back to you. On the issue of the ventilators, we made a request for ventilators from the federal stockpile. Half of it was granted. The federal government sent us 500 ventilators, and we appreciated that. That was based on some early projections on what we anticipated that curve to look like and our hospitalization rate and our fatality rate. Fortunately, that has not occurred. The early modeling, the early assumption that we would be doubling this every week and that would continue, fortunately has not occurred. So the predicted need for the ventilators, which was acute, has gone down significantly because Washingtonians, I believe, have been doing some really diligent, smart things to increase social distancing. So once we saw that it was very likely that we would have enough ventilator capacity, we freed that up for other Americans who might be struggling for breath right now in other states, and returned that to the federal stockpile. Now, another reason for this is that we have hundreds of ventilators that are now in the supply chain coming from the state of Washington some of which are of the higher level. The ones that the federal stockpile gave to us weren't the highest, most acute level of ventilators. So we have in the supply chain, and I'll have to get you the number, but I think it's 950. I'm not sure. I'll have to get back to you on this, that are coming to the state of Washington the next several days and weeks. So we are very confident that we will have adequate ventilator capacity in the state of Washington, and I would not have made this decision if we did not have that high level of confidence. Before we made that decision, we had our epidemiologists look at it. We had Dr. Bono, who's leading the hospital effort, and we had multiple people give me the analysis of this. I want to compliment Oregon and California, who are doing the same thing. Governors Brown and Newsom have made a similar decision, and it's based on the concept that we're all in this together.
You're listening live to Olympia Press Conference, Jay Inslee, Chris Rakedahl. All K through 12 public schools in Washington now closed for the rest of the school year, so at least through June. That is the big announcement. We're also monitoring the president's press conference in Washington, D.C. for you. You're listening to all of this right here on KIRO FM, Tacoma, Seattle. When these press conferences are done, Tom and Curly will take over, and I will see you back here tomorrow at high noon. Take care. God bless. See you tomorrow.
Non-COVID patients to free up capacity where it is more efficient to have the current hospitals treat the COVID patients. This maximizes the utility of the beds and the ventilators and everything else. I think it's a good plan. It's the one other states are using by and large. Now, if somehow the capacity of the existing hospitals was outstripped by the demand, then there might be a possibility of using the CenturyLink assets. But at this moment, that's the best thing to do the most for the most people.
Thank you, Essex. Again, Superintendent Rakedahl here. We are one Washington right now. We are together on this. And the governor's proclamation closes our traditional public schools, our private schools, and our charter schools. We meet weekly with our private school partners. We meet weekly with the executive director of the Charter Commission, trying to make sure we are one state, all caring about kids together. There's concern by all the sectors about the difficult moment that we're in. And just as the public school system may be struggling to connect every single student, so too are our partners on the private side as well. So we're treating this as an education challenge without boundaries. We are seeing this as a need to connect all kids to successful learning, and we're doing that together. So there is not a sector difference right now in what we are attempting to do or trying to do. Certainly small systems have a little bit easier time connecting. They have fewer kids. You've seen big strides in the Puget Sound with some of our larger districts. They've got tens of thousands of kids, lots more of them in poverty, tend to have significantly higher numbers of them. Are students with disabilities that need equitable services. So there's some small differences in the performance here, but mostly you're seeing us unite together to figure this out for families. With respect to AP tests, the AP side of this is that they have moved their testing window out further. They are going to have these tests done at home. That's a private organization that we don't control. I believe they're trying to get these assessments down to 45 minutes or less. And I actually think it's very good that this country is now examining their obsession with standardized tests for admissions to higher education. Right now, we're focused on learning, and higher ed is trying to examine what it means for a student to have mastery of concepts and less obsession with the statistical things that haven't mattered as much, standardized tests and GPAs. Obviously, grades are still important for scholarships and other things, and we're committed to that. But right now, we're unified across the sectors. We're trying to make kids successful, and the testing companies have recognized that in some way as well.
Next question comes from Doug Campbell in the Spokane Review. Yes, Governor, I'm curious as to how the state's going to make sure there is equity in distance learning. On an individual basis, I've heard from some parents that it seems to depend on the individual teacher, how much they get to help out at home. And on a more of a macro level, we know that internet in the rural areas is not nowhere near what it is in some of the urban areas. So how is there going to be equity in this system?
We are going to be as assertive as possible to create as much equity as is humanly possible today and in the future. We understand the importance of fairness for all our students. Every one of our students deserve a good education befitting their particular needs. And I am confident that these districts are going to be as diligent and stalwart to fulfill that requirement. Now, there's a variety of things we need to consider, one of which is my earlier comments that we have built into this a provision that we can consider on-site education for students who have very severe challenges that really require on-site consideration. Some of these children have very profound limitations and challenges, and we think that there are circumstances where they could be on-site for that type of training and education. For others, we are going to ask districts to be as creative as humanly possible. Now, that is a challenge. It is a challenge because there is not uniformity and connectivity in the state of Washington. And, you know, to some degree, I suppose we have to make a decision. Are any of our children getting education or none of our children getting education? We've decided to get the most kids possible to have an education. And with this in mind, that we're going to be creative. Give you another example. There might be some ways that we could consider summer school once we get over this pandemic, particularly for those students that have unique challenges. So this is top of mind. All of the superintendents, the principals, and the educators I've talked to, this is the first thing they think about how to serve the most challenged students. And I feel good about that. And we're going to do everything we can.
I have two questions for Superintendent Reichdahl. Superintendent, the governor had briefly mentioned some small exemptions for buildings, whether it be English as a second language classes, otherwise, what about preschools and other classes? What exactly are those exemptions? And then also, what is your state guidance on what we're seeing already at some schools going to a pass-fail model?
Yes, so the governor's order, both the original and this revised order, creates an exception to the, you know, we're not going to use our buildings for direct instruction to create the safety, but it creates an exemption for food preparation, obviously, which is was deployed within 48 hours. It creates an exception for child care. And to your question, we are mostly serving our traditional age students, so five-year-olds and higher. We've got community partners that do most of the birth to five child care, but there's some of that going on in our buildings as well. So between the traditional private side of this thing and what our schools have created for capacity, at this point we're in pretty good shape with child care. I think there's a scenario where if the science is on our side and the governor thinks it's appropriate as we release more of our economy back to higher productivity, that the child care demand may go up. And we're prepared for that. Your second question, can you please repeat it?
Yes, there have been a few schools already that have either gone through with or talked about a pass-fail model. What's the guidance from the state on a pass-fail model, given this state of where we are on the calendar?
For our kindergarten through eighth grade students, they're not traditionally in a credit-bearing model. We do have some seventh and eighth graders taking high school-level courses. But for most of them in the K-8 system, we're making sure that teachers are aligning student success with our standards, our learning standards, and they're going to make good determinations on that. High school is a different story. When you go to a pass-no-credit model, it works to get students a high school credit. It may be running into barriers in higher education. We're trying to partner with our university colleagues here to create a statewide framework for that, and if they can't create the confidence of our system that students can successfully transfer credit in a pass no credit system, we will work with our districts or take action in our office to create an equitable opportunity. As the governor said, no student's going to be harmed by this. They've got work to do. They've got to work hard to maintain their effort to improve their grades where that opportunity is afforded to them. But no student, due to a global pandemic, should see their GPA erode and risk their higher education opportunity. So we're prepared to take action in our office if we have to. Districts will make that decision at this point, but we're researching some legal tools we have to ensure that their grades are intact, that their GPAs are not impacted, and they have a lot of success transitioning to higher ed.
Mm. I just want to add something. Look, there's a reality we've got to face. In the next several weeks, our K through 12 schools are not going to be the best they've ever been. But they can be the most creative. They can be the most dedicated. They can be the most passionate of bringing everything we've got to the education of our students. And I think that's what we ought to be doing here. Now, this is a hard decision. I know it is, Chris. It's hard for me. It's hard for parents. It's hard for everybody. I got into this business trying to build a high school in Selo, Washington. I've got three grandchildren who are now affected by this. But I do believe this can be some of the best days for education on the measure of what we put into this. And I think Washingtonians are going to do that.